Welcome to the Thursday Arts Preview, where the P is parenthetical. I'm your host, EJ Iannelli. Coming up a little later in this episode, we'll talk to Amawi Phillips and Jennifer Compau of Friends of Mofra. Mofra is the Akan word for children, and Amawi and Jennifer will tell us how a historic photo essay dedicated to child's play became the basis for a cross-cultural exchange between Spokane and Ghana. But even a journey like that across continents begins with a single step. And for the writer Joyce Sullivan, the first step on her own journey from Ohio to Oregon was writing a poem. That poem, titled Instructions for Traveling West, prompted a major life change and also became the basis for a poetry collection of the same name. When I talked to Joy by phone about that new collection, I asked where she was at, not just physically, but mentally and emotionally, when she sat down to write Instructions for Traveling West.
A lot of really the impetus behind this book began in the middle of the desert in Sedona, Arizona. And I was there mid-pandemic. We were all socially isolating, and I just kind of embraced that isolation and went to the desert and was spending a lot of time working and writing. And in that place, I think like a lot of us, I really woke up to this question that has really lingered, which is like, is this the life I want to be living? Am I spending my days in a way that feels meaningful? Is the work that I'm doing purposeful? And so it was those questions that were really haunting me as I began traveling throughout the West. And I was in Ohio at the time working in corporate America. And this was the first time in years I had even been able to travel. And so that question really drove me to start solo traveling and also start thinking about what was the next step I wanted to take in my life. And so while I was in the desert, I wrote this poem called Instructions for Traveling West. And I think anytime you write something down, it's a dangerous, beautiful, magical act, because within 40 days of writing that poem, I had indeed decided to move west. So I had sold my house, I had left my relationship, I quit my job in corporate America and drove west with my two cats and all my books and like seven plants and sort of started all over again.
Yeah, and I guess it was the energy of the vortexes in Sedona that tapped you into some sort of cosmic energy.
You know what's wild is I'm not like a believer in much of that at all, but while I was there, I was taking this hike through one of the places that they say is like the greatest energy from the vortex. And the name for my book plopped into my brain while I was walking on that trail. And like what I wanted to write all came to me. So I'm kind of a believer now.
And so it resulted in this poem, Instructions for Traveling West. And this strikes me as a poem that was written as much to yourself as any other reader. Is that the case? Was this something that that you wrote down as kind of a mandate and a prescription for your own life?
Absolutely. That's exactly right. It was, you know, I think the advice that other people need to hear are sometimes the things you need to lovingly say to yourself. And that's exactly what it was. So I would kind of write down almost in list form, like, what I could do every day, which was to like drink whiskey beside a 100-year-old cactus, or, you know, even the mishaps running out of gas or befriending strangers, but reminding myself every morning, you know, like honor this. And what's a way to do that but by writing it down. And so the instructions were totally for myself. And it's been really special to see how they have kind of rippled out and people have resonated with this list poem.
Yeah, and I want to talk about some of the feedback that you've gotten, but I do want to ask about the decision to move westward, because in America in particular, the West maintains there's this certain allure and this romanticism. It's associated with vast landscapes and openness and freedom. Did you kind of indulge in some of that romanticism when you decided to move westward?
I mean, absolutely. I was in Ohio, so, you know, landlocked state. And then when I got out west, I just couldn't believe how expansive it was. And I think that in the body can feel really big and really beautiful. And so for me, especially in the pandemic, recognizing like I would love to orient my life to be able to access more wild and natural spaces, and also to recognize that that is key to my creativity, to my life force, to my writing. And so I wanted to really reframe my life and my work in posture or position and orientation towards natural, wild, and open spaces. But I will say that in the book, Instructions for Traveling West isn't meant to drive everyone to California or Oregon or Washington even, but to suggest that within all of us, there's like this innate body wisdom that just like birds instinctually know when to fly in winter. I think our body prompts us with very real instinctual wisdom of when it's time to go. And that can be a metaphorical West, that can be a geographical West, but I think we really do know. And so this book is sort of an invitation wherever it is that you're being called to listen to that wisdom of the body.
But that same impulse, I think, puts us in conflict with what we might consider as responsibilities and duties. So there are these trappings or these strictures that bind us all to various degrees. And so for you, a lot of what is contained in this book is about kind of breaking free from some of those strictures and saying those things that I thought were responsibilities and duties weren't binding me as much as I thought they were.
Yeah, you know, I really had this paradigm shift. When I first got into corporate America, I was very interested in seeing how many promotions I could get. And it took something like a global catastrophe to really say, like, God, is this what my life adds up to? And so this reshift of sort of that old narrative that you had to work a 9-to-5, you had to be in corporate America, you had to have a little blue house on the corner of Avondale Ave in Columbus, Ohio, and then you had to stay with a partner until you were ready to get married. And none of those things are bad, and they're all can be beautiful in their own right. But for me, when I really deconstructed the stories that I had been given, there was just another life available for me, and I just felt absolutely haunted by that. And so I think there is, again, that idea that the body is going to prompt us into our next evolution. And maybe we need to like flip or switch the story that we've been told about that, because so much about this book is also unpacking the narratives that we've been given. You know, for me, that was religious undertones of the Genesis story and the character of Eve and that kind of thing. And that's why I spent some time really deconstructing a lot of those old stories, because when we dissect those, we have an opportunity to build a new narrative that can serve us and fuel us towards our new life.
Yeah, I'm eager to talk about two things that stem from what you just said, and I don't know which one to prioritize first, because there is the story of Eve and this exodus, you know, as one of the poems is titled, from an Edenic quality, and maybe that that fall from grace, but also the veil lifting from our eyes and being able to see things in all their facets, and that involves some good and some bad. So could you talk about why Eve factors so heavily into some of these poems?
Yeah, she's kind of an unusual character to just appear, right, in the middle of this book that's largely autobiographical about traveling west, leaving home, finding yourself again, big leaps, right? And then suddenly you have this strange, deconstructed prose poems about Eve and what her story was. And I really fought to keep her in the book because I wanted to examine the story that we all know, we've all been given, of how the world came into being, this creation myth or ideology, and then how Eve plays, especially in women's psyche, and what is our relationship with Eve. And so I wanted to examine her as the first woman who left and the first woman who leapt, right? Mm-hmm. This is a woman who was the first one who really transgressed or really broke out of the story. And so I wanted to reimagine her. You know, we all know that story of Eve bites from the apple, she tempts Adam, and then we get this downfall of humanity, right? And I was really interested, what happens if we reimagine her as somebody who was actually incredibly courageous in ushering in access to knowledge and freedom and power? And so it was really, I mean, just on a personal note, it was extremely healing for me to take a story that I feel has been sort of weaponized and used often to control or shame women and say, what if we shifted this narrative into one that was actually quite powerful? but also to use that as a larger metaphor by which we all have power to deconstruct or reframe narratives that we've potentially been handed often in our childhoods that don't serve us on the road that we're currently walking. And so that's where those poems came from. And they're sort of sprinkled throughout the middle section of the book. And then she's referenced in a few other places as well.
Yeah, and then with this foundational poem, the title poem, Instructions for Traveling West, each of the mandates or the advice that is contained within this initial poem then becomes its own section. So realize you're homesick, commit to the road, reacquaint yourself with desire, remind yourself joy is not a trick. And so these become the much fuller sections in this book called Instructions for Traveling West. Why did you feel it was necessary to tease out each of those and then flesh them out with additional poems?
Yeah, I think for me, I didn't have that idea until very late in the process. I really wrote it as kind of, you know, the arc of a leap, right? And then actually living the book and writing the book, I did not feel that was true anymore. And I just remember, you know, a lot of poets do this when they're putting together a collection, they print off, you know, all 150 pages or how many poems are in the book, and they just organize them. And I had all these papers all over my living room floor trying to figure out what the leap arc was. And I kept coming back to that idea of like, yes, there's been this sense of belonging that's become ruptured, and there's been this big leap, but I don't know that it's come back to some kind of Edenic, peaceful, well, now I'm home and everything's perfect and I'm so glad I leapt and everything worked out, because it didn't feel true to the experience. I'm so glad that I leapt and so glad that I am in this new season, but putting a bow on it felt really false, and I didn't want to make art that wasn't true. And so going back to those sort of beautiful invitations in Instructions for Traveling West, the poem, I wanted to sort of use those instead as guideposts, because I don't want to suggest to anyone that it's always easy or it's not incredibly lonely or incredibly hard to leave everything behind and reinvent yourself. I think we can't always get the promise of home, but we can get the promise of joy.
And lastly, one of the things that I wanted to talk about was the feedback that you've received from readers who followed your journey and then have read your poetry and also drawn their own inspiration from it and did really take some of these mandates and some of this prescriptive advice to heart. Has all of that feedback been positive, where people said, you know, I made a positive life change? Or have you also encountered some feedback where people said, I did this and I had mixed results or mixed feelings about it?
Yeah, you know, I'm sure people tend to just share the good stuff with me. But I do have people say, you know, I took a big leap in my career and I found out that, God, I don't want to be a creative entrepreneur. I don't want to make my art pay the bills. That's too much pressure. I just want to make art for art's sake. Or, man, I moved to Chicago and I hated it. And I moved back to Ohio. And so I think for me, it's overwhelmingly positive. I think when you listen to that instinct, you just have relief because you've done the thing, right? You've done the thing that you inside of yourself is truly asking for, that quiet, quiet voice that sometimes gets lost in the din of everyday life. So what I hear from the most from people is the more I listen to that instinct, the happier I feel, the more confident I feel. And I think generally that's an exciting, expansive feeling.
Well, Joy, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out to talk about Instructions for Traveling West and, you know, everything that precipitated it, as well as reading for us on Poetry Moment this week.
It's been such an honor. Thank you so much for having me.
That was the Portland-based poet Joy Sullivan talking about her new collection titled Instructions for Traveling West, which is out next week through the Dial Press. Joy is being featured on our Poetry Moment this week, so you can hear her reading Instructions for Traveling West, as well as other selections, by going to our website at SpokanePublicRadio.org and clicking on the Poetry Moment tile. A new round of Spokane Arts Grant Award recipients was just announced at the start of this week. And we've been waiting to catch up with friends of MOFRA, who received SAGA funding during the last round. Their project, called Playtime, Then and Now, will introduce Spokane to a landmark book of poems and photos through an outdoor installation in Riverfront Park. Amawi Phillips and Jennifer Compau of Friends of MOFRA came into the studio to talk about the project and its inspiration. And our conversation began with that key word, MOFRA.
MOFRA is a word from the Akan language in Ghana, which is the language that I grew up speaking. And my mother was an Akan. And so this really stems from the fact that my mother was a writer and did a lot of work around education and children and culture. And so she had started an organization called MOFRA Foundation in Ghana. And so when I came here, and over time, it became clear that there were enough people around in Spokane who were interested, along with me, in fostering relationships between Spokane and Ghana in terms of children and nature and culture. We just decided to pick on that word as well.
And how exactly does that cultivation of culture around children, what exactly does that look like?
Well, here in Spokane, having a relationship with Ghana that is based on parallel programming and interests around children. So the organization here and the one in Ghana are different organizations, but their missions do overlap. And so for us, it was really important for us to have a way in which young people in Spokane could engage internationally, to have some kind of cultural sensitivity about themselves and the fact that there are things that happen with children in another country in much the same way. And so Jennifer particularly has been wonderful about finding ways in which we program activities for children and young people here in Spokane that resonate with the same sorts of programming in Ghana.
Yeah, and Jennifer, I'll bring you in just a second, but I just wanted to tease out the idea of culture, because there is culture in the sense of what we experience in a day-to-day society.
Yes.
And then there is also culture, maybe with a capital C, where we think of arts and literature. So when you speak of culture, does it encompass all of these things?
It does. We have a particular focus on the arts, literature, literacy, things like that, simply because of our own backgrounds here in Spokane and in Ghana. I mean, I grew up immersed in the arts and literature in Ghana. So that's what we mean. But what we draw on to deliver those kinds of programs is the everyday world, you know, of people. And in Ghana, there is really no clear line between culture with a capital C and everyday living.
And Jennifer, how did you come to be involved in Friends of MOFRA?
So our paths overlapped, and we were both raising our children, and I was immersed in the arts here in Spokane, had grown up in a family that had the same kind of passion and interest for here and there, you know, and people here and people there with dignity. And so we'd listen to Amawi's stories about being in Spokane and then going back to Ghana for the summer and working in her mother's legacy, you know, and it really was engaging. And after a few years, she invited us to participate to form the Friends of MOFRA here that would steward that connection with children and nature and culture and like the arts.
And you had mentioned Amawi's mother's legacy, and this is probably a good time to introduce Playtime in Africa and this book from which so much proceeds. So I would love it if you could describe Playtime in Africa and just what it contains.
So Playtime in Africa is a photo essay from 1960 by Ifwa Sutherland, my mother, who wrote the text for it in the form of small prose poems. and the photographer Willis Bell, who was an American expatriate who lived in Ghana for many years and who I knew as a child quite well. So they collaborated to create this rather extraordinary little book. And I say extraordinary because for its time, it was not the sort of thing you would expect to be coming out of a newly independent African country, which was expected by the world to have certain priorities. And along comes this publication, which is about play, play in all its variation, but from the perspective of a new modernizing African country. So that in itself made it unique. Playtime in Africa was actually very well received here in the United States. I'm still amazed to hear sometimes that in somebody's attic they found a copy from 1970, but it was in many American library systems, in school libraries and so on. So I found that the book itself was a wonderful touchstone for a lot of the ideas about children and enrichment, you know, in culture, in play, that we have come up with, not just in the organization in Ghana, but here as well.
And that brings us, with much happening in between, to Playtime Then and Now. And I don't know if you wanted to speak about this, Amoi, or if you wanted Jennifer to speak about this saga-funded project that has its roots in Playtime in Africa.
It does have its roots in Playtime in Africa. And in the past in Spokane, over the years, we've staged exhibitions, you know, kind of museum quality exhibitions in galleries and at the library and places like that. And we've done a lot of things inside, with always the hope that we take some things outside and make them more public and more shareable for people. With the expo anniversary that's coming up, that got us thinking about what would it be like to stage an exhibition juxtaposed with the children's playground that's down in Riverfront Park. The Ice Age playground is beautiful, and you see kids in the playground doing the exact same things that you see in the pages from the 1960s publication of Playtime in Africa. They're in the sand, they're in the water, they're chasing their shadows, they're just, you know, engaged in all different levels of play. And so that's what we did. We contacted Shelley Winecoop, and we noodled it around and came up with a grant, and we're really grateful to receive the funding that we needed to do this exhibition.
And so what is this exhibition going to look like? So as people are walking through the park, or maybe playing in the park ideally, what are they going to encounter?
The exhibition is going to be staged as pole banners. And the pole banners are going to be lining the little walkway that goes along next to the Ice Age playground. And you're going to see children playing in much the same way that you'd see reflected in, you know, the children actually playing in real life. And so that juxtaposition, that play, I'm hoping that people go away with the recognition that play is universal. It is timeless, you know, throughout culture. 60 years ago in Ghana, in Expo 74, you know, 50 years ago, that there's that resonation that we were all kids and we did play, and we played wherever we were. That's what I'm hoping, that people really just kind of have that nostalgic reaction, you know, to their own childhood. And if they are a child, to kind of look and see themselves in the art that's going to be on display.
Yeah. And I would assume there's also a drive or a desire for folks to want to recapture some of that and maybe tap into that childlike sense of play where you just play with abandon.
Yes. For the opening event, it's all ages. So families can come with little tiny kids and their grandparents if they want to. And there will be Moncala games on the tables and books and things. And so, to me, sitting together and playing with the child under a tree, or sitting together and reading a book with the child in your lap, whatever it is, you want that multi-age experience shared. And I think it really does form us. It, you know, we really did benefit from playing with our grandmas and playing in the park and listening to music together and doing art and thinking about it.
And so it's multi-age, but Amawi, it's also multifaceted and multimedia as well. So this isn't just helping people reconnect with playtime and maybe establishing some of those cross-cultural parallels, but also reawakening an appreciation for the book itself and the photographs and the poems that are contained therein.
Oh, absolutely. It happens to be the centenary of F.W. Sutherland this year. So that's a very nice coincidence with the 50th anniversary of Expo. And part of the mission of the centenary program is to reintroduce this rather remarkable woman to the world and to new generations. So this exhibition really serves very well.
And Jennifer had answered this in part, but I was hoping that you would give me your take on what you hope people experience at this exhibition and how they leave, maybe changed from this exhibition.
I think that it's important for us to remind ourselves all the time about what a small world it is and how interconnected we are. And I feel as though every opportunity that we have to tell this story is important. So the exhibition will certainly help in that regard, just for people to recognize that there's, as Jennifer said, this universality about what we do here, what children do in other parts of the world. And I would very much like to see the exhibition perhaps have another life beyond Expo, perhaps be shown in other places in the United States, or ultimately perhaps even return to Ghana. I feel as though the children in Ghana will recognize those images, certainly, but they will see the way in which they've been beautifully presented, you know, with dignity. And that's also an important message to send to children wherever they are.
Yeah, it signals an appreciation. And in that way, too, this photo essay comes full circle and almost
Indeed.
Comes home again.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I want to thank both of you for coming in today and talking about this. And yeah, making Ghana seem so much closer.
Thanks, EJ.
Thank you.
Jennifer Compau and Amawi Phillips there, speaking on behalf of Friends of MOFRA and their upcoming outdoor exhibition called Playtime, Then and Now. That exhibition received Spokane Arts Grant Award funding in the final round of 2023. Playtime, Then and Now runs in Spokane's Riverfront Park on Friday, May 17th, as part of the 50th anniversary celebrations of Expo 74. More information on both the organization and the event is available at friendsofmofra.org, and MOFRA has two M's. This has been the Thursday Arts Preview, a show that keeps an eye on the past, present, and future of the art scene throughout the Inland Northwest. If you'd like to listen again or catch future episodes as soon as they air, subscribe to the Thursday Arts Preview podcast on major platforms like Spotify, TuneIn, and Apple Podcasts. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm EJ Iannelli.